Welcome back to the Iron Chef Fuzzing Challenge. This is part two of our show, and just in case you missed part one or maybe slept through it, I'm going to recap where we are. You are here. We've done all of the bug hunting. We're ready for chefs to present results, and then we'll have our judging. So, our chefs, once again, are Charlie Miller, apple hater, assisted by Jake Honoroff, his sous chef. And Charlie is a principal analyst at ISE. We've got Sean Fay, chief architect at Fortify Software, assisted by Jeff Morrison. And we've got you. If you've taken the code, found some bugs, you'd like to present to the audience, please come and find me once I get through with these introductions, and we'll get you on the queue. So, the prize is dinner with the judges, the chefs, and Jacob and I tonight at Mandalay Bay's Mix Restaurant.
That last part might actually be a penalty. You can decide.
Once again, our judges are Wendell Snyder, Michael Sutton, and Jared DeMott. We'll hear from them really soon now. The secret ingredient is the Firefly Media Server. It's a young piece of software. We'll see if it's going to make it to old age. If you don't want to look at C code and you'd rather look at a web app, check out thehackingchallenge.com, and maybe we'll get Charlie to sign the iPhone. You win. All right. Now it's time for presentations from our chefs. We're going to start with Charlie.
All right, Charlie. Hi. So that was about the most nerve-wracking 60 minutes of my life. I'll just dive right in here. So what did we do? We used three fuzzers against this program, ProxyFuzz, GPF, and Sully, and I'll talk a little about each of those and how they work and what we did. So ProxyFuzz is like the most brain-dead simple fuzzer in the world, but we're really worried on getting things going up fast, and this is pretty much the fastest fuzzer you can set up. So it's basically just a Python script that sits in the middle. You send your data to it instead of the server. It will just randomly insert anomalies into it and send it onto the server. And so it doesn't know anything about the protocol. It works on any protocol. So it's really stupid, but it just randomly inserts stuff, and sometimes that's enough. So this is the diagram of how it works, if you can see it, since it's like way over there. So the client, you have to write a client script. So we wrote, in this case, DAP. So we wrote some scripts that just talk to a DAP server. We wrote scripts that talk to an HTTP server. We wrote scripts that send out MDNS packets. And basically, instead of going to the real server, it goes to this cloud proxy fuzz, which then fuzzes the packet, sends them on, and then it gets the response. And that's it. It just does it over and over and over. It has no idea that, anything's really going on. Anyway, GPF. So GPF, it starts, instead of sending live data through it, it starts from a packet capture. Jared DeMott is the author of this tool, which is just a fantastic tool. I love it. So the way that it works is you have these things called tokades, and it's basically C code that you write that describes the packets to the fuzzer. And so you can tell it things like, hey, this byte is a link field, this byte tells you a type of data to follow, and so forth. So you can describe the protocol to it. And that makes it a little smarter than ProxyFuzz, so hopefully it does a little better. And then once it knows things, then it again, the point of fuzzing is you insert anomalies into it. And it can do it intelligently in the sense that if there's a link field, it can fix up the link field, where ProxyFuzz doesn't know anything. And likewise, if there was like a checksum, it could fix up the checksum. And again, ProxyFuzz can't do that either. So if you want to see what one of these tokades look like, and probably me and Jared are the only ones in the world who've ever written one of these things, looks like that. So it's just C code, and if you can read it on the top there, it says like, okay, the next byte is going to be a link field. It's going to take in the next token as the length, and then the next thing is an ASCII string, and so forth. And so you just basically walk through and you describe it and see what the packets look like. And this is the picture. I was like really going crazy on drawing pictures. So you got packet capture. You send that in GPF. You give it a tokade, or you just use one of the ones that come with it, which work on like just plain old ASCII. It tries to figure out what the protocol looks like to the best of its knowledge. And then it just fires over and over and over, like thousands of times, packets that have these anomalies in them. Okay. And then the final fuzzer we used, and this is the one that if you're watching the screen when I was up there, this is the one I was using. It's Sully, and it was written by Pedro Momini. It's a framework instead of a fuzzer, actually, and the difference is that it needs you to tell it everything, basically. So you have to tell it exactly how the protocol works, every bit of it. So you don't give it packets to look at. You don't give it a packet capture. You have to tell it, oh, this is exactly what this protocol looks like. So I had to write a thing that says, okay, the DAP protocol from, there actually is an RFC, but from some guy's webpage I found on the internet. This is what the DAP protocol looks like. And then likewise, HTTP and MDNS. Then what it does is it just works through systematically and it knows everything. It knows what's the link field, what's whatever. So it goes through and it can fiddle every single field in the packet. And unlike the other fuzzers, so it knows everything about the protocol. Proxy fuzzers knew nothing. GPF knew everything about the packets that you were sending, but not necessarily about the whole protocol. So it only knew about the certain packets that you happened to capture. Where Sully knows everything there is to know. So it goes through, and there's a finite number of test cases it sends. Each one's important and tests something different. So it's sort of a different kind of thing. And if you want to know what one of these protocol descriptions look like for Sully, here's part of one of the ones I wrote for the Bonjour protocol MDNS. So you basically tell it, like, okay, here's a block of data. And then further down, you see, like, a size. So it's like, okay, this is going to be a size of the block string. And then it describes the block string, and it's just, an ASCII string there. And so Sully will go in there and put in the right link there, no matter what fuzzed string it happens to put in. So hopefully it'll get a little further into the program than otherwise. And here, you just feed it a specification file, and then it just goes through and sends out the corresponding test cases. Okay, so we came in with a plan, right? So we tried to be as organized as we could, because if we were sitting around, that's every minute we sat around was a minute we weren't looking for bugs. So the plan was we each took two computers. On this computer, I just ran Sully against HTTP and DAP. And on this computer, I ran all three fuzzers against MDNS. And the reason I did that was I figured if this thing is, so we were told in advance that it was going to speak, this Bonjour protocol, and Macs already do that. And so just to make sure that, it must have code that does it, and I know Linux doesn't. So to make sure I was testing the code, I ran that on this server, since it's a Linux box. Anyway, and then Jake over here was doing GPF on that box for HTTP against the web application and against DAP, and he was doing proxy fuzz here. And so then after like 30 minutes, we switched. All right, so that's fuzzing. So that's, we're sending lots and lots of packets, but you also have to know when something goes wrong, right? So it doesn't help if you send like a gray packet and the program dies and you don't know it. So on the Mac, we were using a tool that we wrote and we can provide to you called Mother Fuzza Monitor. So what it is it's a Python script. We like Python, at least some of us do. And it sits in the middle of your traffic, so you take any fuzzer, and instead of sending the fuzz packets at the server, you send the fuzz packets to our monitor. And the monitor doesn't change the packets, it just forwards them on, but it records what's going on. So, like, for example, proxy fuzz, it's just blindly inserting anomalies into your packets. If after, like, 20 minutes, the server eventually crashed, you wouldn't be able to repeat that without running the whole thing 20 minutes again. And so what this allows you to do is, since you've recorded everything that happens, you know exactly what data you just sent to the server before it crashed, so you're able to repeat it. So it records the fuzz data and the responses. Also, it attaches to the target server in this case, like a debugger. And that way, if there's any exceptions, it can handle that and it can make note of it and record the context or whatever it wants to do. Likewise, if it crashes, it can restart the program automatically for you. So you can, that's why we got to sit back, because I didn't have to worry if something went wrong. I knew the monitor would take care of it for me. So one of the highlights is you can just replay. The packets that you've sent, you don't have to restart the fuzzer. At that point, the fuzzer's out of it. This monitor will replay the packets if you want. And the other good thing, and this is sort of the reason we wrote it in the first place, was it works no matter what the fuzzer is. So, like, Sully can kind of monitor an application by itself, but, like, proxy fuzz can't, GPF can't. So this is a way that you take any random fuzzer and you can monitor the program. And this is what the picture of that thing looks like. So you send your fuzz packets inside the server, you send it to the monitor, the monitor just forwards it on, records them, and then attaches to the target with... In this case, it actually uses PyDebug ported to Mac in order to monitor the health. Okay, so that's what we did, and that was the plan. And so here's like my time to sort of like make excuses about how like I didn't find $1,000, right? So why was this like particularly hard? Well, this target, like I don't know, it was 30,000 lines of C, which you know maybe isn't a lot, but it actually does a lot of stuff, right? So it's a web server. It serves you know MP3s with the DAT protocol. It's a web application. It listens to MDNS requests and maybe other stuff that we don't even know about because I didn't really look at it, right? So we had 60 minutes, but we had to like configure and build on four machines between the two of us. So that took some time. If this was real life and some, you know, like one of our clients brought us this program to look for bugs, like obviously I wouldn't spend 60 minutes on it. I'd spend like maybe a week or two. So, it's
excuses. Let's get to the meat, Charlie. Come on.
This is just building up to how great it is that we did something, right? If you don't know what the challenge was, you don't respect the accomplishment. Okay. So anyway, so then the final point here is that like you saw actually all the hard stuff that I would do over 2 weeks. It's just the 2 weeks time would just be sitting back. So you've actually seen the hardest part and you missed out on the fun, easy part that I like to build my clients for. Okay. So in particular, what didn't I do that I wanted to do, right? So, like I explained, Sully, you really want to send every single test case. You can't, like, GPF is just randomly doing stuff. So if you turn it off early, well, maybe you missed something, maybe you didn't. But it kind of got a chance to do its job, right? Whereas Sully, if you only send the first 10 packets, then there's definitely part you haven't tested. So anyway, the DAT fuzzer had 26,000 test cases. The HTTP fuzzer had 58,000. And I just couldn't send them all. So I probably sent, it was Sully, maybe 5,000, 10,000 packets. So there's tons that I didn't test with Sully. I just didn't have time. What else would I have done if I had more time? Our fuzzers basically had no idea what we were going to fuzz, so we just had to fuzz like the most generic DAP server, the most generic HTTP server. So I didn't get a chance to look at this program and what it did specially with HTTP to customize the fuzzer. And that's really where you find a lot of bugs. So I didn't do that. So what else didn't I do? Well, so I'll show you here in a second that I actually got code coverage of how the fuzzing was going, which is an important thing to do. But I didn't really have a chance to look at it or go back and generate more test cases that would make it even better. And I'll show you that. Okay, so let me show you to get an idea of what we tested and what we didn't test. So I collected code coverage when I was fuzzing DAP with Sully, just to see, you know, really just to show you that this is a tool that when you're fuzzing that you can use and it's helpful. So most of the code is in this directory. So what this does is I compiled it with gcov such that it would record which lines were hit, and then you can see which lines weren't hit. And that's important to know that means I didn't fuzz those lines. So I would go back and make my fuzzer better to fuzz these lines. And so, like I said, this was when I was fuzzing DAP, so I should, you know, I'm guessing that most of the DAP code is in DAP.c. I'm glad that they named it something like that. And so you can take a look here and see over on this little sidebar what I hit and what I didn't hit. So the blue lines I hit, the red lines I didn't. So you can look at something like this. So all these red lines are things I didn't do, and I wish I would have, because maybe there was a bug in there. And likewise, there's whole sections down here that I didn't even hit this function. It says, handle the DAP block for the databases, containers, URI. So I obviously didn't ever do that with the fuzzer. And maybe that was because the fuzzer didn't even know about that, or maybe I ran out of time. But anyway, I just wanted to show you that that's a tool that you should use when you're fuzzing, code coverage that is, in order to you know, see what you need to do and improve your fuzzing. Okay, so that's that. And then the final thing is so we found one bug, which I'll show you. And I don't know what it is exactly. I know it's not like just a null pointer to reference or something. So it's I don't know if it's exploitable, but it's not like totally trivial. So here I'm going to start. Can you see? Can you like read this or not? I can make it bigger probably. How about that? It's like a crazy find out. But that's okay. Okay. So I don't know. Jake's taught me how to run GDB. Thanks, buddy. Okay, so it's running there, and then, yeah, that's what sous chefs do. You're right. Okay, and then I'm going to use the repeater, and Jake's actually the author of the repeater, so it's a great tool. And it's just going to resend some of the test cases that the monitor earlier when we were fuzzing detected caused a crash. So it's going to send these three. And then it gets these sig pipes, so you just continue through. and it'll eventually segfault. So it dies on this some sort of copy, right? It's going to an address that looks like it's not mapped. So it's some sort of copy, you know, off the end of some page. I don't know any more than that about it. Give me more time and maybe I'd look at it. What's that? Matters what? Yeah, so what Jake's pointing out is it's actually a write as opposed to a read, so which is potentially more exploitable. So if you if you're reading from some random spot, it's not likely as exploitable as if you're writing to some random spot. So it has a potential to be bad, but all right, that's what we found, that's all we have.
Why should the judges vote for you, Charlie?
Boy, I don't know.
That's compelling.
Yeah. Why should they vote for me? Well, we actually, you know, crashed it. So if anyone was running this on their server and they were trying to you know, give out MP3s to their friends, and I worked for the DRM companies, I could, like, crash their server. And, you know, in like a day, maybe I could take over their server. And
is that a possible career move you're proposing, working for the DRM companies?
You know, I would love that. Because I know that that'll be a job that I'll have for a very long time, because they're not going anywhere. So, now that's all I can say is we found one bug, and it's like, as a challenge to them, it's a real bug. I can crash the server, and that's where I'll leave it.
Thanks, Charlie. All right, I'm going to give the judges. Do you guys have any quick feedback you want to give Charlie, or should we wait till you've heard both presentations?
So, I mean, this is actually a very serious competition here. I mean, we have the opportunity here to put to rest the age-old debate between fuzzing and static analysis. And so I take this very seriously. And, you know, we were joking about the whole the performance-enhancing drugs. And, you know, I last saw Charlie at RSA, so it's been a few months. And I got to say, he's bulked up since then. What are you, about 80, 90 pounds now, Charlie? Yeah. So I really hope that we won't, you know, validate these results until a full urine analysis has been completed. Do you want us to go through all the comments, or do you want to just...
Go for it. Early feedback. We'll refrain from making a final decision, but tell them what you thought.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you on my feedback. You know, early on, Jacob pointed out that there may be a bias here because I've written a fuzzing book, but I actually see it as the opposite. Charlie wrote a competing fuzzing book, so he's hurting my Amazon ranking. So
Jared, on the other hand...
Right, but his co-author is over here, so I think that bias will balance itself out. Charlie, let's talk about what we saw there. So I really like the fact that you took different approaches to fuzzing, like walking through the different tools, kind of the dumb fuzzers, which are actually really smart. I mean, you know, why take the hard road? I mean, take the easy road first, and then you try different approaches. One question, like, I don't know anything about the tool that you fuzzed, but, you know, based on what it is, I assume it's delivering media files and things like that. Would there have been any value to file format fuzzing on this as well?
All right, so as far as I can tell, you know, I obviously didn't take a long time to look at it, but I'm thinking that it serves file formats as opposed to parses them, right? So and I could be wrong because, you know, I had all of like 2 minutes to study the source code, but so I'm thinking that
60 actually, Charlie.
Well, you know, I was doing other things during that time too. I don't think it's designed. It's supposed to deliver content as opposed to upload, but maybe there's a way to do that. I don't know.
Okay, that's cool.
I don't know either.
I didn't know the answer. Really, I like the thought process of, you know, the upfront effort that you put in. You thought through, hey, I got to fuzz these protocols. You had to make some templates doing like Sully and stuff. So that was good. That really liked the whole code coverage piece. I think that's a really important point to make to people. I'd say very few people at fuzz look at how much they've hit. We always ask ourselves the question, how do I start? We don't ask the question, when do I stop? And you can never answer that question if you're not doing something to track how much of the application you're hitting. So that was really smart. I really liked that point. The downside to what I saw here, I'm just not convinced on the whole steroid thing. So.
Window, what did you think?
Well, since it's August, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about snowboarding. And, God, I love snowboarding. I really like watching people snowboard, too. And sometimes you see people, you know, going down the mountain, and they're just, like, they're just ganking the snowboard left and right. They're really putting a lot of body into it. They're, like, they're just jerking it around left and right. They're not, like, really moving with the mountain. One of the things I really like to see is you see sometimes snowboarders are, like, just totally, like, chill, laid back, and, like, just riding the mountain just so smooth and just laying back and letting it happen. And that's one of the things I really appreciate about these tools, this set it up and then, like, sit back and watch and wait and for it happen. You know, styling maneuvers, okay, that's pretty cool. It belies the amount of preparation that's required to be able to execute without so much labor during the actual process. So that's styling. I give you points for that. But then Charlie goes to the ramp, and he's going for this backside Indy 720, and it's looking pretty good. But the landing is kind of wobbly because it's rideable. That's cool. But we're not sure about it, so you know, that's something. So you get points for that. But you didn't stick the landing; it didn't look smooth. So that's kind of where I am.
Jared.
Okay. Well, as for a bias, as for maybe Charlie's got me in his back pocket. I don't know. We'll have to see about that. But I do have to say I like the flavor of the mac and cheese or whatever it is he cooked up here, the cake. It just tasted good to me because one of the ingredients was GPF. And I don't know what it is about that ingredient. It's just like every time I put that on my burger, it just tastes good. So I respect that. And then as dessert and a little bit of icing on the cake, you know, you color it up with that nice green and red and color code coverage and stuff. So I got to respect that. That's my early comments. I'm looking to see what the other guys cook up here.
Good stuff. All right, Sean, tell us what you found.
Is that one on three?
Yeah.
Are you sure it's on three?
Yeah, three.
Oh, is this one? Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, we're making use of both screens. Good move.
Damn it, I should know what second.
So now that we're up and running here, so I'll just talk real quickly about our approach. We have the advantage of having played this game before, so we get to learn some lessons the first time around. So one of the things that we decided was that this time, rather than focusing on sort of breadth and really getting as much coverage on the application and looking at all the issues, we're really going to focus on getting going as quickly as possible, narrowing down focus on a few issues and seeing what we could really delve into in detail and potentially even demonstrate to sort of make it feel a little bit more real for the judges. So we spent a few minutes getting the application up and getting it compiled. I think we got about probably only about 70% of it compiled. We saw 20 files out of
28.
Out of 28. So yeah. So there's a bunch of code that we didn't even get to look at, but we didn't want to spend too much time on that. We just kind of drilled down into what we got going. So I'm just going to walk through a few of the issues that we found using our auditing interface. So we're going to look at some code, and I'm going to explain what I think is wrong with the code, and we'll just go from there. So. Starting out, we're going to look at what our tool has identified as a potential buffer overflow. So we're looking at this. We're in this function scanStaticPlaylist. It looks like it's looking at a directory
and operating on some entry in that directory. So right here at line 476, we see a stir copy from the directory name entry into this M3U path buffer. And taking a look at that declaration, we see that's declared with a static size. So it looks like pretty suspicious code. It's not the kind of code that you want to see. There's really no guard on that operation to make sure that that buffer isn't overflowed. Now, looking into this in a little bit more detail, it looks like probably the built-in limit on the size of a file name would prevent this from actually being an overflow at runtime. But that's really system dependent. And the size of this buffer path max isn't going to necessarily be related to the size of that file name string. So it looks suspicious, but we didn't really go any further than that. It looks like probably it's not actually exploitable. It's just some bad looking code.
But one of those infinite inputs must tweak this, right?
Potentially. So moving on, we're going to look at some more kind of suspicious looking code here. So this code we also flagged as potentially being a buffer overflow. And what's happening here, go look at what function context in. So db pack record is the name of the function. And what it appears to be doing is taking some kind of ID3 MP3 description and packing it into a binary structure, apparently for storage in a database. So what the code does initially is try to figure out how big is the structure that I need to allocate, and then I'm going to pack it full of data. And it does that by looking at all these strings that came through on the ID3 tag and adding them all up. Well, that seems pretty safe. I mean, assuming you didn't make any mistakes in the math, it's probably going to work out okay. But there's definitely a danger here that you're going to end up overflowing this variable, and that could give an attacker a way to potentially exploit this. So they give you an ID3 tag with a bunch of really, really long strings in it. Now they can cause the len variable to overflow its bounds, since it's just an int. And now you're going to end up allocating a really small buffer instead of the really big buffer that you need. So pretty dangerous looking code there, although it'd probably be pretty difficult to figure out how to exploit it. So let's look at one more thing here. So this is another example of copying some data around into buffers without being too careful about it, or not being quite as careful as we'd want them to be. So we see here we're taking this path string and appending a slash and another token onto it. So we're copying into this buffer called path buffer, which we see is a static buffer allocated with path max. And we've guarded our copy operation and said that we'll only do this copy operation if the length of the path buffer plus the length of the token that I'm copying in is less than path max. So it sounds pretty safe, except that we forgot to take into account this extra slash character that's getting appended here. So this looks to us like it's probably an off by one error, and an attacker could potentially figure out how to take advantage of this to write an extra byte onto the stack. So one extra byte may or may not be able to do a lot of damage with that, but it's another example of this sort of endemic code problem that we're seeing here, of not being really quite careful enough about manipulating buffers.
That's a lot of maybes and potentially, Sean. Do you have a big finish coming up?
Is that what you're looking for? Okay.
So are they.
So let's take a look at this one. We looked at this guy and we thought, that looks pretty suspicious. So what we saw here is we've got this sprintf on line 1751, and we're printing a string into this buffer fdesker, which we see is allocated on the stack and has a fixed size of 50 bytes. And so we're printing a string into it, %s audio file, and then we're passing in the type of the song. So we decided to go back and figure out, all right, where does that type string come from? Because when we looked at the declaration of this, it's just a plain old string. It doesn't seem to have any length limit on it. So we trace back through, and we figured out where that's coming in. Let's see if I can find that here. Okay, so we found the assignment to type back here. And we noticed that basically what they appear to be doing is trying to take the file extension and storing that. They're considering the file extension to be the type. So we thought, that sounds like a pretty sketchy thing to do. So let's see if we can come up with an exploit for it. So Jeff, why don't you show them what we did there?
So the first thing we tried, of course, is you make a file with a long extension. And you run that. So I just put in 80 underscores after a dot. It's a 50 character buffer. Ran that, nothing happened. It said, I found no files, I scanned nothing. What check is it doing to figure out what a file is? And that's down in scan file.
Scan file is
up one. This is scan file. Should be at the top of this loop. Well,
okay, I'll dig up the code.
We'll get it here. But what it's doing is it's checking the extension on this file against the list of known extensions. So it'll only, as we said, this is a media server, it'll only serve up a fixed set of extensions. So that set of extensions is in the config file. So what we figured is, okay, we'll just put in a matching extension. We'll make a 80 underscores MP3. Well, that doesn't work either because the default configuration asks for, where is it?
But if you encode it with UTF-8, it'll be okay?
The default file types have dots in them. So it has to end in a dot MP3. That's not so great because it's taking everything after the dot. If the dot is in the extension list, it's hard to get past that check. So we tried a couple of things. Well, if I change the config file, if I make underscore MP3 a suffix, then that this does work. But that's not really satisfying, changing the config. I can add a 4-character extension. That'll work. That's fine. What we came up with, though, is the way they check this is extensions here is a string. It's not a list. It's a string. And they check to see, are those last 4 characters in this string? Which means I can end my file name in MP3 comma. MP3 comma is in my config file. So if I run and I ask it to scan this directory, it's like vault. Because it's trying to read that string name and put it into that 50-character buffer. Doesn't work. So I could easily imagine getting a comma or a 4-character extension or something past anybody's filter. It's just an MP3 file. It's the song I want. But as long as I can make a substring of that extension list be my last 4 characters, I can overflow that buffer. And I can put whatever I want onto that stack buffer. You need that.
Sean, why should the judges vote for
you? I told you we were
going to
break it. What?
Why should the judges vote for you?
Exploitable stack buffer overflow with a pretty clear path that you can pretty clearly imagine how somebody could figure out how to exploit this remotely. I mean, if I know you're running this MP3 server, and I know you like Britney Spears, I just put up some.
Hey, what are you trying to say?
I just put up a zip file on my favorite file sharing service with a bunch of these corrupted file names in it. And pretty soon I've hacksawed your box, as it were.
Anything else?
That's it. We were pretty happy with that.
Excellent. So judges, if you don't mind giving the same sort of feedback just on Sean's presentation now, and we'll give you a couple minutes to collect your thoughts and make your final decisions. If anyone in the audience has any bugs, I encourage you to come up and talk to Brian. We'd still love to see something from the crowd. There's an extra seat at dinner tonight. I hate for it to go empty.
Bias was revealed that, you know, I tend to use fuzzing over static analysis, but it has nothing to do with the fact that I don't like static analysis. It's just that it looks way too hard, and I'm lazy. And I was watching the guys as they were doing their stuff, and you know, I watched Sean was and Jeff were always poring over the computer, working really hard, and chilling Charlie over there was had his feet up, looked like he needed a beer in his hand. So at least that confirmed for me that static analysis is something that I need to just avoid because it's just way too hard. it's very impressive to any time that I watch something with that to see, you know, the level of understanding you get with the code. I mean, that is a definite advantage to static analysis. I think you get deeper understanding of what's actually occurring, but, you know, it takes some effort to get there. I also like the fact that you were negating what I think is the biggest shortcoming of static analysis is the false positives piece. So you weren't just saying, hey, I think this is vulnerable. You guys were going back and actually doing a proof of concept, if you will, and saying, hey, it did or did not crash. And you admitted to us that there were some that you thought might be exploitable. You found out that they actually weren't. On the downside, just beyond the whole fact that it's just way too hard, you know, we're judging on presentation style as well. This is Iron Chef. I didn't hear a Japanese accent from any of you guys. But, I mean, you both have to be faulted for that. So that's equal.
So when I first got to Mozilla, I think it was about maybe a couple of months, not even, like maybe 6 weeks after I got there, a security software vendor, shall remain nameless, that has a static analysis tool, announced that they had run their tools on the Firefox data source code and had identified 300 red flags or 300 and something just ridiculous like that. And we went through all of those red flags and found zero actual vulnerabilities. That was not very compelling for us in terms of static analysis tools, and fuzzers have been very successful for us. So I was definitely excited to see what you guys had to say or what you were going to pull out on this, because I was, I'm definitely one of the false positive haters for sure. And so I'm watching you walk through the presentation, like you got something over here, something over there, maybe it's exploitable, looks kind of bad, and it looks, you know, like, you know, the kinds of things that we see, like, oh, that construct looks bad, but when you dig a little deeper, you find out that even though there's a construct that in some circumstances might result in a vulnerability, doesn't actually result in a vulnerability in this case or that case or this other case or any of these cases. But you pulled it out and you found something that actually looks pretty bad, and you've got a scenario for it that involves remote exploitation. So I think that this requires that static analysis requires a second look for me anyway. I'm feeling it.
Okay, so I admit my background on static analysis is a little shy, and so it was a cool opportunity for me to see the tools run. And it seems that what maybe I thought was true is kind of true in the sense that it's better for companies that have their source code available, right? So if you want to do static analysis against IE and you don't have the source code IE, it's going to be kind of hard to do, right? So you have to have the source code, which is first and foremost. I think for code coverage, you kind of need that sort of, not really at all. Yeah, we could use PyMate, that's true. For the tool you use in this case, you need it, but. So you definitely need the source code to run the static analysis tool, which to me is a huge drawback if you're a security researcher. If you're a software dev firm, on the other hand, you have the software, and you want to run tools against it. And to Michael's point, it does give you a greater understanding when you see red flags, you're writing the source code, you're kind of checking it out, and you're digging deep into it. So that was pretty cool to see.
Okay, nobody from the audience found a bug? Okay, we'll try the online version, see if you find something there. We'll give the minutes a moment, judges a moment to think of their final votes, and we'll find out in just a second.
Can you guys confirm one thing for me? Were any configuration changes required for that comma?
No.
The question was, were any configuration changes required for the vulnerability that we saw here? And the answer was no. The question is, was the vulnerability that Sean's team found definitely exploitable?
Well, what we can say for sure is that we can write a bunch of bytes onto your stack. Going through the work to figure out whether that's whether you could develop a feasible exploit for that, I mean, it seems pretty certain, but I guess there's a possibility that there's some limiting factor in there that would make it difficult. we took it as far as seeing the seg fault. And we know from looking at the code that the data that we're overwriting is on the stack, so we can look right here. Yeah, we could probably do that. We didn't we got to this pretty close to the end of our time, so we didn't take it that far. But it's we're pretty confident from looking at the code that that we can capture the return value, return pointer.
Okay, have we lived in suspense long enough? Jared, you went last all along. Why don't you go first this time? Oh, yeah. Have you got a mic? Charlie wants to beg.
What do I get?
Sorry?
Do I win something for real?
For begging? No.
Oh, okay. Never mind. I thought he was saying what prize I won, but I was like, I don't think I win anything. Oh,
so, I've got a great book for you, actually. It's about fuzzing.
Oh, yeah, that book sucks.
Yeah,
I have that one. So for their bug, you have to trick the guy to unzip a Britney Spears file. And for my bug, it's pre-authentication. You just send the packets and own them. That's all I want to say.
Sean, do you want to come back to that or let the bug speak for itself?
Who wouldn't download a Britney Spears file?
Okay, Jared, what do you say?
It's on. Okay, here we go. So you kind of stole my thunder there, Charlie. I was definitely going to point that out. You know, hey, a local priv against a remote. What can I say? To me, the fuzzer guys laid it down. It's not even close. They just destroyed them, in my opinion. They ran their tools. They found a remote. I was going to go through this whole thing, but to me, it's just it's a butt whipping. So,
still making up your mind, Window? Ouch!
That makes you know the last one. That could be important. So. I mean, first off, huge kudos to you guys. I mean, to sit up there, finding bugs is hard, period. I don't care if you're locked in your little cave with no sunlight, wearing all black, and not shaving or showering for a week. It's a hard job. And so for you guys to sit up there on stage and do it live in front of an audience, that's impressive. Give it up for these guys. That's And so, I mean, to me, the bugs were fairly close, different ways of doing it. I mean, I really liked the upfront work you guys did. Like, you thought through how you were going to approach this, and I think it was a very logical way you did it. I'm definitely very impressed with, obviously you guys are very good at what you do. You obviously were able to, in a very short time span, understand a lot about how this functioned. So with that, I have slightly more confidence about the ultimate exploitability of the static analysis bug, so I'm going to give it to you guys.
Okay. All right, Window, you've chosen an important point in the judging now. It's 1-1.
So I got to say, I told you why I was surprised about static analysis, pulling this out, and I think that for me created this. I was so surprised that you guys managed to find something in a short amount of time using static analysis tools, that really created an impact for me, but. But the scenario is a little complicated compared to a remote vulnerability that you can just send a packet to. And I think in terms of identifying, which is exploitable, you guys are almost in the same position for it. So the scenario, got to go with the fuzzers.
All right, we have a winner.
Congratulations, Charlie. Thank you for joining us for Iron Chef, the Fuzzing Challenge. If you've got questions, you want to know more about the code, please come and talk to our chefs. Thank you.